Hello and welcome to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. My name is Andrew Dalbo. I'll be here with Josh and Henry discussing all the good and bad about Arsenal Football Club. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to episode 16 of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. And this is an especially exciting one because for a few weeks me and Josh have been holding the fort down. And for the first time in probably about a month or so, we get to welcome Henry back into, I was going to say the studio, but we do this over Skype, so it's not really a studio. The virtual studio. Hello, Henry. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. As I told you just before we began, my exam stress has been replaced by the Arsenal stress. So all is good with the world.
Yes, and I'm not really sure, if I'm honest, which one is better or worse.
Neither am I.
Probably depends how the exams go, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Also, which is another exciting thing, Henry was actually live at the game last night. So do you want to give us a bit of a kind of story of why you were at the game? Obviously, kind of where you live and then also how it was, how the atmosphere was and things like that.
Yeah, I'm happy to explain. So I was born in Swansea. My dad's originally from Swansea. And although I've spent the majority of my childhood growing up in Cardiff, during the university application process, I decided I wanted to go to Swansea because I love the courses and offer there and the location of the university itself next to a beach. And it was ever since I've been a university student here, I've gotten to watch every single Swans home game with my dad. And it's just a tradition almost that we go to every single game now. The game yesterday was the best of both worlds for me. I get to see my two favourite teams go at it. But it was a horrible game from an Arsenal perspective, a brilliant one from a Swansea perspective, and the performance on the field was reflected by the abject atmosphere in the Arsenal section of the ground. I mean, I think they were all just appalled at what they were watching, to be frank.
Yes, it wasn't the most enjoyable of games ever, I think is probably the best way I can describe it. Josh, how did I know you didn't watch the game live, but you have since had the pain of trawling through that absolute mess. How did you find it?
I actually probably had one of the worst game watching experiences ever because I I was going into class and the last thing I saw was that Mkhitaryan wasn't starting, which I kept telling myself, if this happens, I need to be alone by myself. But I wasn't. I was in class. And then I got out and I came home and I tried to find a way to watch it. And not only was it horrible to watch, but the stream was terrible and it kept freezing and I kept having to reload. And all the time I kept asking myself, what am I reloading for? What am I hoping to see? You had already warned me that it was a pile of crap. It was my one hint on how the game went because I was very dedicated to not finding out what happened. And I sat through it. I sat through every minute of it until the final whistle, even though I knew. About the 75th minute, I Googled the score because I couldn't take it anymore. I still watched it. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Yeah, it was.
We've become numb
painful,
to the
painful
feeling,
experience.
Haven't we? Numb.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think for me personally, the most depressing thing was the fact that I'm not surprised anymore. It doesn't
exactly. We're numb to this entire experience at this point.
No, it just doesn't shock me anymore, which is very depressing. As we were planning today's episode, we kind of came up with a few topics that we're going to discuss. So, firstly, Arsenal's striking problems. Certainly, there was a definite lack of creativity and movement in the team. Josh, I'll go to you first. How did you find Alexander Lacazette's fairly anonymous performance?
You know, this was the first thing that I sort of wrote about after the game, because for a while there, we had talked about this a lot. The goal drought didn't really bother us because he was doing other things. And there is still always a value to be found. I mean, he created the most chances of anyone on the team. There is a value to be found in that. But when you think about why we purchased him, it wasn't to create chances. It was to finish the chances. And because if he's not finishing them, then who? Ozil's there to create chances. Mkhitaryan's there now to create chances. Lacazette didn't attempt a single shot. And you can't blame that all on him because he is a service required striker. But there were times during the match where even the announcers were pointing out Lacazette's not making the runs. He's kind of dawdling, sort of maybe he's waiting for something to happen. He didn't look as into the game as into the match as he has before. And I really worry more and more each time I see him out there that he's really unhappy. He doesn't look like he's enjoying himself out there. And, I mean, apart from the one goal he scored where he literally lost his mind, he was so happy. It's been, for the past few months, he's looked just completely miserable, and that really worries me. I really do hope that Aubameyang being here is going to sort of wake him up a bit. Because, I mean, you never want to judge a guy from his first 6 months in the Premier League, but you do want to see some semblance of what he's going to be. And I hate to say it, but I haven't seen what I've wanted to see from him. There's time to change that, though. There's plenty of time.
Yeah, it was a worrying performance. I've got a few rather depressing stats to give you.
Oh, goody.
on Lacazette in particular, Lacazette's performance. The first one is he had 39 touches of the ball in total. That is two more, for example, than Lucas Fabianski. it's the least of any Arsenal player on the pitch, other than two players. One is Petr Cech. The other one is Olivier Giroud. Henrik Mkhitaryan actually touched the ball more, even though he was only on the pitch for maybe half an hour, something like that. In the second half, he had no touches in the box, in the penalty area. And he had, there's a brilliant stat on Who Scored that give you an individual possession share. So he had 2.2% of the possession. To put that into context, Jordan Ayew, Swansea's centre-forward, had 2.3% of the possession. If that's not bad enough, Swansea as a team had only 25.3% possession. And Arsenal had 74.7% possession. So they had three quarters of the ball. And Lacazette had... I can't even do the maths. What's the maths?
Don't ask me. 50th. I'm not the person to ask.
Yeah, he had... So Arsenal had three quarters of the ball and Lacazette had a 50th of the ball. I mean, that's just... Part of that is his fault. His movement was poor. He didn't really hold on to the ball very well either. But a lot of that is also on Arsenal's general play, especially in the midfield, that was too slow, too lethargic, a little bit aimless. They didn't get the ball into him quick enough or accurate enough into his feet. So it was disappointing. Henry, you made a point that it changed a little bit when Giroud came on. And we'll obviously touch on this more later in the podcast when we move on to talk about the difficulties or the sadness of perhaps seeing him leave. You believed that Giroud made a difference in this game, didn't you?
I thought he should have just started this game alongside Lacazette. I know Josh has been clamouring for weeks that this should be trialled. But it was a game where we knew going into the game how Swansea would line up and how they would play. We knew that in a similar fashion as to how they played against Liverpool and Tottenham, that they would play five at the back, they would sit deep and try and take the limited chances that they had. The difference between Liverpool, Tottenham and Arsenal is that Arsenal are a lot more susceptible from a defensive standpoint than the two aforementioned teams, the two other aforementioned teams. But it didn't make sense to me having both Xhaka and Elneny on the field, as well as Iwobi, as well as Ramsey, who don't excel with intricate passes around the box or with their backs to goal. They prefer to... Well, Xhaka and Elneny were rendered almost useless in this game, essentially. They were anonymous for the most part. I just simply thought Giroud should have started because he could have been the focal point of the attack, giving Ramsey, giving Lacazette, giving Ozil someone to pass to, and giving Ramsey and Lacazette someone to run off. Because Federico Fernandez bullied Lacazette all game with passes into the 18-yard area. He couldn't hold the ball up.
Yeah, there was one moment that was especially concerning when there was a ball played through and Fernandez not only outpaced Lacazette, he then outpowered Lacazette when it came to battling for the ball. And that was, I guess... indicative of his domination of Lacazette throughout the game, and certainly Giroud did provide a bit of a physical presence. I don't necessarily agree that he should have started, but I can see the argument, and there's certainly an argument to be had about the midfield selection, We'll come on to the general team selection in a second. Josh, you are the biggest fan of Granit Xhaka. However, this was, for me anyway, this was his, I actually gave him a zero in the player ratings, and I still think that's being kind. How bad was it? From someone who is a traditional Xhaka fan, how was it that bad?
No, it was really bad. yes, I'm the biggest Xhaka fan in the world. I think it's at the point now where, and you're going to laugh at me when I say this, but I don't completely blame him from the standpoint of, I don't understand why Arsene Wenger hasn't done something about it. It reminds me a hell of a lot of whenever we were all so upset about Giroud never being benched. When you bench a guy, it's not like a crushing, career-altering, he's never going to recover. It's a wake-up call. It's letting them know that what they're doing isn't good enough. And for so long now, there are a lot of things that Xhaka does right. I don't want to lose that. But the things that he does wrong are so obvious and so glaring, but they seem like they'd be such an easy fix if you just drove home the point that it's not good enough. I don't know why these short passes that he sends straight to the opposing team still happen. I don't know why he watches runners. Those are things that shouldn't happen, and again, seem like an easy fix, but you keep sending him out there after he's made these mistakes as if there's absolutely nothing wrong with what he's been doing, and it's not like we don't have options. I mean, I would love if next time out against Everton, you sit him on the bench and you start Wilshere, Ramsey, Elneny, anybody. I mean, you have to make the point that it's not good enough or he's never going to improve. All you really have to do is knock out these two big problems that he has, and they don't even feel like big problems. It seems like just teach him to focus a little more. He's an intelligent player. You see that he's an intelligent player. I don't know if he zones out or what, but if you can get rid of that one little flaw in his game, then he'd be brilliant. You just got to find a way to do that.
It is a little bit infuriating and a little bit confusing as to why he's so bad. I mean, there was a moment for Elneny made the interception, didn't he, midway through the first half, and this was before either goal, I'm fairly sure, and this was when I started to get concerned about Xhaka's performance. The Arsenal lost the ball. I think it was Iwobi. Somebody lost the ball anyway. Xhaka does his kind of traditional rampage up the pitch where he doesn't really think. Goes after the ball. Two passes later, he's completely out the game. And then instead of busting a gut to get back, you kind of see him walk around a bit, shrug his shoulders, and then slowly jog towards Arsenal's goal. Meanwhile, Nene is absolutely killing himself to try and get back into the box, and then eventually makes a good interception to stop what would be a goal. And it was just a very, very painstakingly obvious disparity between the two players, just in terms of effort. It wasn't ability, it wasn't even speed, there was an element of stamina in there, but really, it was in the first half, it just looked like he couldn't be arsed.
Yeah, I mean,
Which, when you add on his problems, is a real issue, isn't it, Henry?
I mean, yeah, I agree, actually, with a lot of what Josh has to say. I mean, if you look on Twitter, there's this desire from Arsenal fans for Xhaka to control a game, and I find it very weird because, in general, Arsenal can't control a game, for the most part.
No.
When he gets it right, he's our pendulum. He keeps us moving. His distribution is excellent. But, again, referring back to what you two have already mentioned, there are too many mental errors being made on his part to validate a weekly starting spot. Considering his price tag, the bare minimum I expect from him is effort, which I'm getting more from Elneny. I'm getting more effort from Elneny. So moving forward, I would love to see midfield heading into the game against Everton next week, who I assume will be more adventurous in their tactics than Swansea. I would love to see an Elneny-Wilshere-Ramsey midfield combination, because I think it could work very nicely next week.
Yeah, I mean, I know me and Josh on this podcast have talked a lot about the Xhaka, the Ramsey-Wilshere double pivot type axis. I don't really know how to describe it. Basically, Wilshere and Ramsey playing together in the centre midfield. But you need to be able to have that holding player alongside them, and we initially thought it would be Xhaka, but perhaps Onene. To be honest, the guy I'd like to see in there is Ainsley Maitland-Niles. Whether it will actually ever happen or not is probably another question. But if I'm looking at the future and looking at who we can build this team around, Xhaka, I think, is a fine squad player and rotational player. Elneny is fine for the odd game, but can you really build the midfield on him for a whole season? Probably not. You need to either have a good look at Maitland-Niles for the next few months, and then if you decide he's not good enough, then you can go and spend your £40-50 million in the summer on a proper world-class anchoring holding midfielder. Let's just touch briefly on Ramsey, Josh. He returned for his first start since he left with his hamstring injury. I think it's about 2 months, 2.5 months, something like that. He looked a little bit rusty, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, this is what everyone knows Ramsey does. He plays so well, he gets hurt, and then it takes him a while to get back in. And, you know, for the record, I agree. I don't think this was the kind of game that favored his strengths. We talk a lot about him versus Wilshere. This game favored Wilshere much more than it did Ramsey. Unfortunately, Wilshere was sick, so we had to do with Ramsey. But, I mean, that said, if he had been in peak form without the injury, he would have made an impact on this game. It's just this is the byproduct of his injury. He always takes a few weeks to get back into it. And, you know, hopefully we see better from him against Everton. I really do, just to touch on again the idea of Wilshere and Ramsey in the midfield, I really do hope we see that, because I think the potential is there for that to be something special.
We will get onto this later in the podcast again, but I wonder if we will see it with the rather sexy front four that Arsenal will hopefully have lining up together. You, Henry, mentioned briefly about the team selection, in particular the selection of Xhaka and Elneny in centre midfield. What would you have changed other than obviously bringing in Giroud up front alongside Lacazette?
I think Mkhitaryan should have started, like Josh has already mentioned. So my lineup would have been, I would have personally started Elneny had Xhaka dropped to the bench. Elneny, Ramsey, Lacazette, Giroud, Ozil and Mkhitaryan. And then the same back four and check and goal is how I would have started. Simply because I think it was more suited to the game plan that Swans, I think it would have been more effective considering the tactics that Swansea were implementing.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Certainly, Wenger himself said, I want to switch to the back four because it allows me to get another attacker on the pitch. And then when he gets the chance to do that with a world-class talent, if not world-class player, he decides to put him on the bench.
Yeah.
That very famous acclimatisation process that Wenger unwaveringly sticks to is again reigning. Unfortunately for Arsenal, I'm sure we'll see Aubameyang on the bench on Saturday evening against Everton. we all know it's going to happen, don't we? We all know it's going to happen. He'll come on in the 62nd minute for Lacazette.
He'll start a Wobi as a second striker.
He will.
Stop it.
He'll play the front four. Will be Mkhitaryan as a Lacazette, and then he won't be.
He needs a loan.
You assume Mkhitaryan's going to be starting. I don't know if Mkhitaryan will be starting. Not with Arsene Wenger making the team selections.
No, that is true. Poor old Iwobi. He does get a bit of flack, doesn't he?
Yes.
He needs a loan badly, as I just said, so badly.
Yes. We have primarily focused on issues in possession, but it would be remiss of all of us to not talk about how poor Arsenal were without the ball, especially on individual cases. So maybe let's go goal by goal and discuss the defensive mistakes that were made. Josh, I'll come to you for the first one. Obviously, we talked about Xhaka and just being blind, apparently, or ignoring what's in front of him. Do you also portion a little bit of blame to Elneny for not pressing up onto Alfie Mawson when he could have played the pass? Do you perhaps suggest that Koscielny should have been more aware of the run, and obviously Ozil lost the ball as well? How do you kind of share out the blame, I guess?
I mean, I was annoyed that Ozil, I believe that's the one where he lost possession and kind of sat on the ground.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we've kind of been through this. I'm past the point of expecting Ozil to track back, defend, to get a bug up his arse every time he loses the ball and go after it. That's just not who he is. So, I mean, I still think he deserves a portion of the blame. He probably was fouled a little bit, but, I mean, I don't want to rely on that. I would say it's like 75% Xhaka's fault, maybe 20% Elneny, and what remains is Koscielny. I don't blame Koscielny because Jordan Ayew had him pinned, and the run was behind Koscielny. I think Koscielny knew Xhaka was there, so he when you know one of your teammates is behind you, you just trust that he's going to do something. And what really baffles me about Xhaka is he knew that nobody else was going to pick this up. He was standing in line with the defense. He saw it all happening in front of him, and he did not do a single thing. I would love to see a slow motion of his eyes, and if his eyes even watched Klukas go in front of him. I feel like he was just staring off into oblivion, not expecting to have to do anything. And, you know, I'm changing my answer. It's 90% Xhaka's fault. It's 5%. I mean, I do wish Elneny would have closed. I always wish that our midfielders would close down quicker than they do, because they seem to just allow people to have possession just outside the 18-yard box. It drives me nuts. I wish they would just close down a bit better. But yeah, between Elneny and Xhaka, I think they deserve the blame, with Xhaka having the gross majority of it. That was, even for an eternal Xhaka apologist like me, that was really hard to watch. I was shaking my head like, there's nothing I can say here. He just completely screwed up.
desperately trying to find a way to defend him. There is one thing that I can say to at least not completely crucify Xhaka. Oh, there was a Swansea player wide of him. I think it was Olsen, perhaps, but I'm not quite sure. But so he stood in the defensive right channel, inside defensive right channel. Klukas is about 3 or 4 yards on his right shoulder, and he's going to run across his face. There was another Swansea player further wide, and Xhaka probably wasn't ready to commit to following Klukas because he was aware of the Swansea player right on the flank. The problem with that is, firstly, he didn't look aware anyway, so that may be giving him the benefit of the doubt that he knew he was there. The other problem is you're taught to defend narrow to wide. This is fairly schoolboy stuff. If you're a defender, you start narrow, the threat is straight down the middle, defend that first, and then defend wide. So if you're in a 3-on-4, for example, the three people will defend, for example, the width of the penalty area, and if they outflank you, you wait till the pass goes wide, and then you go and charge the ball down. Xhaka did, assuming he was aware enough anyway, he still did the complete opposite. He chose to defend the wide ball, and then worry about the one inside, which was too late. And even when Klukas got the ball, he still didn't run. He just watched
him. I mean, the question for me is, was that I believe that goal came about, a Mustafi clearance ensued, and Ozil lost the ball. The only thing I'm thinking of, referring back to that goal, is where on earth is Hector Bellerin?
I think Bellerin was with Mustafi as he cleared it. They kind of tackled, one of them tackled the player, and then the other one cleared it, if I remember rightly.
I can't remember either, but if it's a case of, you're completely right with regards to the tactics of it to defend narrow as such, but he's another player, Bellerin, who I'm questioning more and more each week.
Yeah, the thing with Bellerin is he can make defensive mistakes because he's got such great pace. So he can make them positionally and then recover for them. Sometimes he doesn't get away with them and it costs him. The problem with Xhaka is because he doesn't have that pace, he has to be aware defensively. You compare the classic comparison would be somebody like Xabi Alonso or somebody like Sergio Busquets. they're not quick, but they don't need to be because their awareness, their intelligence, and their reading of the game is absolutely outstanding. Xhaka needs that awareness and that ability to know where the danger is coming from because he doesn't have the pace of, say, a Bellerin to recover his position. The problem with Xhaka is he has neither. He doesn't have the awareness or the mobility and the athleticism to cover. So both weaknesses combine for just a terrible player.
For me, for Bellerin, it's more of a case of I'm frustrated with his offensive output. He has all of this pace. I've never seen him, or I've rarely seen him, take on an opposition defender at the byline and then put in not only a cross, but a cross of any note whatsoever. It's becoming slightly infuriating.
There was one good cross yesterday from Bellerin. I remember watching it and thinking, oh, that was incredible. And nobody got on the end of it, but there was, I will give him this, there was one good cross.
I want to say, though, there have been times recently where, I mean, if he looks into the box and doesn't see anyone, why would you cross?
I mean, exactly, this goes back to my point of Giroud needing to start the game in a game like this where Swansea were always going to sit deep.
Yeah, and I think that having Aubameyang there is going to help Bellerin immensely because he's going to have more confidence. When he does get to the touchline, or when he does get to the touchline and whips a ball in, he does have good delivery there. He doesn't do it enough. And I think that's just because when you look in there and Lacazette's kind of at the edge of the 18-yard box and you don't see anyone else, there's nothing to gain from it. So I agree. I think Bellerin's been disappointing, but you've got to give him the weapons to succeed. Otherwise, he's not going to reinvent himself just on the fly because there's nothing there to utilize his strengths.
Yeah, that's a fair argument in reflection. And again, it's just, for me, it's another reason why Giroud should have started.
No, I agree, yeah.
What is a little bit frustrating with Bellerin's crossing is that he seems to try and pick somebody out rather than, sometimes I'd rather see him just flash across into the box with real pace and not, rather than try and aim for somebody, just pick out an area. So say, I'm just going to hit the front post, or I'm just going to lash it across to the far post, or I'm just going to pull this back and hope that somebody gets on the end of it. Because quite often they're the far more difficult crosses to defend. And actually, somebody like Lacazette is sharp enough to be able to adapt to a cross that hits an area rather than hits him specifically. So especially when you don't have the physical presence of Giroud there, I would rather sometimes Bellerin just says, I'm just going to whip this across, across the edge of the six-yard box or something and see who is willing to gamble. And the more times he does that, and the more times he does it successfully, the more likely somebody like Lacazette or a late run from Ramsey or Monreal at the moment at the back post is going to make that run and gamble on getting on the end of those crosses. Let's move on to the second goal. You mentioned it briefly, Henry, that Monreal shouldn't have let the ball go out of play, should have kept it in. Wenger said the same. He said he shouldn't have then passed back to Mustafi. Mustafi probably shouldn't have passed back to Cech. And I agree with all of that, but the large portion of the blame has to rest on Cech's shoulders, doesn't it?
Oh, certainly. I mean, once Mustafi received the ball, he had Nathan Dyer approaching fast. There was no other option for him but to go back to Cech, which is absolutely fine in that scenario. But Cech suddenly decided to turn into a rabbit in headlights with two Swansea players fast approaching and had a moment, I can't even describe it. It was just so bizarre. Just watching the game, you expect nothing, but it's just one of those that you tell all these young footballers, keep harassing, keep chasing, you'll get your reward. That's exactly what Swansea got for their second goal.
Yeah, and credit should be given to Swansea because they were willing to put Arsenal under pressure. And it was terrible from Cech, but it's just one of those things, isn't it? It's not like it's a lack of ability. It just happens every now and then, unfortunately, that a keeper don't kick the ball properly. Perhaps the more concerning factor is that Cech is now becoming a bit of a liability defensively. I still think he's a good keeper. He's clearly not at the same level as he was two or three years ago, especially when he was in his prime at Chelsea. And he's also not really making any outstanding saves where you say he has just won us that game or got us that point.
Mm.
You look at David De Gea at Manchester United, for example. I could right now, off the top of my head, single-handedly pick out two or three games, against Arsenal being one of them, where he single-handedly won United points. I'm not sure you could say the same for Petr Cech this season, which is a little bit of an issue. Josh, I'll come to you for the third goal. Do you criticise Mustafi for getting absolutely skinned by Jordan Ayew, as he did for the majority of the game, to be honest?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of annoyed by Monreal trying to black belt ninja kick the ball out of there.
It was weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, Mustafi does deserve blame, but to his credit, he did get there, and he made an effective stop. It's just that stop ricocheted right to, I forget who it was, Ayew, whoever scored it. Yeah, I think it was Ayew.
I used Mustafi and it fell to Klukas,
Gotcha, yeah. But I mean, it was a deflection off of Mustafi, so Mustafi technically did his job in recovering. It's just the ball ended up with Klukas, who, Klukas, by the way, 3 goals this season, all against Arsenal, which is just wonderful.
Yeah, and he's only had 3 shots on target all year as well.
Oh, even better. It gets better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that one was tougher. Obviously, it's defensive mistakes yet again, and I think the thing that gets me is, every time we make these defensive mistakes, it's like it looks like the Arsenal defenders never expected that they'd be under pressure in a match like this. Why wouldn't you expect against a team that's fighting for their lives that they would pressure you? They look completely baffled. Monreal did. Aside from the goal, I thought Monreal was pretty poor too. Mustafi was poor. Koscielny wasn't his best. It's like they expect to be able to control the game, and whenever they can't control the game, they just go into panic. And this isn't I feel like I'm saying the same thing that I've said countless times before. Why wouldn't you expect Swansea to do what they did, to put the pressure on you? And the better question is, how are you not ready whenever the game doesn't go your way? I don't know. These are all questions that obviously I don't have an answer for, because I'm asking them open-endedly to nobody. But I just don't get it.
No, I agree, and it's a preparation issue, isn't it?
Yes.
They just didn't look ready at all. You know, if you fail to plan, you should plan to fail, and that's what it feels like with Arsenal, desperately badly. Let's end our little review of the Swansea debacle. We'll move on to the transfers in a second. I just want to ask one final question. Arsenal are now 8 points behind Liverpool in the race for the top 4. Henry and Josh, both of you, will come to Henry first. Is that game over in terms of the qualification for Champions League, through the Premier League at least?
Yes. I've been very vocal about my opinion that we are the worst team in the top 6. I've maintained that opinion since the defeat against Stoke, because it showed me that our mentality still isn't any different. So I think the Europa League is our best chance of qualifying for the Champions League, and I'm actually relatively confident with that to an extent. That was weird. But simply because we seem to do a lot better when in a knockout kind of format, because we know that there's something to play for. We're not as consistent as the current top 3 in the Premier League. We're much more like Tottenham and Liverpool, who can beat anyone on their day, but we're a lot more inconsistent, and we lack this defensive solidarity which is required for consistent success.
Mm. What do you think, Josh?
I don't think it's over, but I think we are one more drop points away from it being over. I can't imagine that Liverpool and Tottenham both won't drop points the rest of this season. I mean, for as inconsistent as we've been, they haven't been as inconsistent, but they've shown moments of being just as bad. I don't think Liverpool's defense has shaped up the way they want, even with Van Dijk. I don't think Tottenham are gonna win out through the season. I think that we still have a chance, especially with these new signings. Again, I do think there's something wrong with the team mentality, and I don't think that Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan's gonna just change that on the fly. But if they can, maybe they do inject some life into the team. I mean, we have the ability to pass them up. It's just a matter of being consistent about it. And I guess the Europa League makes me nervous because, from my understanding, we can't use Aubameyang in it. And Giroud's gone, so
we're
a bit limited there, and that really worries me. I would hate to see us get all of these players and then miss out on the Champions League. That would be really catastrophic.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up in the next section, so we'll talk about that. But certainly there was a lack of depth for the Europa League, which perhaps should be Arsenal's main priority for the rest of the year. We'll see how that plays out. For now, let's take a short break before we come back. And for what I've again a little peek behind the curtain for Henry in particular, because he's not been with us. I have bemoaned talking about January transfers for the whole of January. I hate talking about transfers. I absolutely detest it. And for once, I get to not talk about football, which is good, and talk about transfers and contracts and agents and all the stuff that I traditionally hate. I can't wait. This is going to be fantastic.
Football's won on paper, Andy.
Yeah, football is won on paper, the famous saying. So we will come back in just a moment and discuss all of Arsenal's transfer dealings. We'll see you in just a sec. Hello and welcome back to the second part of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast, where we are going to talk about transfers. And I am very glad to report that Arsenal have signed somebody. Not only have they signed somebody, they've signed like a proper player. They've signed someone that you've actually heard of in Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang for what is thought to be about £56 million. Apparently there's a £20 million bonus clause if Arsenal win the title, so Aubameyang will cost £56 million. Are you happy, Henry, with the deal? We'll talk about the Giroud aspect later. Just in terms of the player, are you happy with the addition of Aubameyang?
Yes, because now we have two world class strikers on our books, and a striker who is one of the most prolific in Europe, and I hope and I pray that we see both he and Lacazette and Mkhitaryan and Ozil in the same team.
Oh, gosh.
Arsene Wenger, make it happen,
I can't
please.
Wait. I can't wait. I can't wait.
I can't
see...
wait for the defensive lapses. All of them.
I can't wait to see Alex Iwobi on the left wing.
Oh, no.
Josh, just in terms of the player, are you happy with the signing?
Yes, with the added clause, as long as we see him and Lacazette both as strikers, don't try to shoehorn one of these people onto the wing. We saw it against Swansea when Giroud came on. Giroud was up front and Lacazette found space behind him. Aubameyang's the same thing. I think I saw a stat where I think like of his last 95 goals, like 94 have been scored inside the box. He is a poacher. In every sense, you just have to get the ball into the box. And I think it's going to help Bellerin. I think it's going to help Xhaka. It's going to help Ozil. It's going to help anybody that enjoys passing the ball into dangerous areas is going to find a very willing recipient in Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. So, yeah, I don't know why you wouldn't be happy with him.
Yep, I agree completely. And actually, I think the fee is outstanding.
Yeah.
If you look at, say, Alvaro Morata was really nothing more than a rotational player at any other team that he played at. He was never the number one guy. Aubameyang is cheaper than him. He's not much more than Alexander Lacazette, who'd never played outside of France. He was cheaper than Romelu Lukaku, who, while he had an excellent goal-scoring ratio, there were concerns over his kind of general overall play. I think, in terms of reputation and calibre, Aubameyang is a better player than all three of those.
Well, I mean, even two summers ago, we were linked to Aubameyang for like a 90 to 100 million pound move, and that was completely reasonable. I thought that'd be great business, and we got him for nearly half that.
Yeah, so for 56, 60 million pounds, whatever report you tend to read, it's in that kind of range. That's an excellent price for a real top tier player. One problem I have, and you both brought it up, is how they are actually going to use him. The fact that you had to add that caveat of they need to play Lacazette and Aubameyang as strikers shows probably what we actually think is going to happen is Wenger's going to do the reverse Thierry Henry of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and shift him back to the wing. Or he's going to play... He's going to play Lacazette as a inside left forward in a 3-4-3.
Or Mkhitaryan's going to play in central midfield and yeah. erase all of our defensive midfield woes.
Yeah.
It's just going to... They're just going to disappear.
There was a journalist, and this was a good 4 or 5 years ago, and she... It might have been Amy Lawrence, but I can't quite remember. Anyway, they were on the radio, and they were talking about Arsene Wenger's obsession with changing the position of players he buys. So they actually
So they actually
went back all the way back to somebody like Laron, who was signed as a right winger, and he turned into a right back, and it was a successful decision to turn them into that. They talked about Wiltord, who was signed as a striker, and he turned him into kind of a half winger. Talked about Henri, who went the other way. Talked about Vieira, who was really signed as a proper holding midfielder, and he pushed him into a bit more of an advanced role. And it was a really interesting point. She was basically saying that Wenger has always had a bit of an obsession with trying to mould players into the position that he wants them to play. And it's almost like he will do it for the enjoyment of it, even if it doesn't better the team. He almost wants to prove his own ego that he's so intelligent in seeing the abilities that these players have that they've not shown previously. And I fear that the same thing may well happen here with either Lacazette or Aubameyang. What do you think, Henry?
I mean, I've noticed that, and that you can argue the same can be said for Xhaka when he was playing in Germany.
Absolutely.
My understanding was that he was playing in a role that he's been playing recently, more of a box-to-box midfielder with less defensive responsibilities. I have no issue with Wenger trying to mould players or to change their natural positions per se, because as you mentioned, we've had success doing it in the past. I think shoehorning is possibly different, and I think at this point we've realised that Xhaka lacks the natural defensive instincts to play as a natural holding midfield player, but then he lacks the qualities needed to be a box-to-box central midfielder in the mould of Wilshere or Ramsey, for example. So he's a difficult one to place. I don't think it's necessary to appease his own ego that he does this. I think it's simply because he sees the benefits of those qualities that an individual possesses in a different position on the pitch, which is absolutely fine in my book. But sometimes it's not going to work, and sometimes it'll work.
Yeah, and he also loves versatility, doesn't he? He's always been a manager who likes his players to have the intelligence, the positional intelligence to play in a number of different roles and be able to do them successfully. You look at how he has nurtured somebody like Jack Wilshere and Aaron Ramsey, where they've played every role in midfield, even on both wings they've played.
Yeah.
And part of that is because of injuries sometimes or suspensions, but I think a lot of that is also that Wenger wants them to be able to see the game from a variety of perspectives and then use the knowledge that he's garnered from all those different avenues, I guess, and then mould a more well-rounded player rather than having a positional specialist who is completely restricted and limited to one specific role and one specific way of playing. Josh, do you think that Aubameyang is here to not necessarily replace Lacazette but push him pretty hard, or do you think he's here to partner him?
I mean, he's going to push him regardless. I don't think that's why he was brought in. It's not very Arsenal-like to give a guy 4 or 5 months and then not be satisfied and then decide you're going to push him. I mean, we went 4 years with Giroud without pushing him. But it's still going to have that effect. I think he's here to partner. I'm trying to set all of my nasty thoughts aside that he's here to be a winger, and I really want to believe that he is actually here to break Arsene Wenger's fear of using two strikers. Because for whatever reason, ever since the Invincibles era, he just has been so drastically opposed to using two strikers regularly. And it, I mean, even when we had Podolski, he was a winger. It doesn't make any sense to do that whenever you have the capabilities and all of the required ingredients to have an effective formation with two strikers. So, yeah, I think he's here to partner. At least that's, I hope, I guess.
Yep. On that, do you actually think that he's going to play all four? And by four, I'm referring to LMAO, Lacazette.
They're a good band, by the way.
Yeah, Lacazette, Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang, and Ozil. Do you think that he is actually going to play all four? And do you think it's actually going to be a good thing that he plays all four?
He better play all four, and yeah, it's going to be a good thing. I mean, the best thing I can think of is you got Lacazette and Aubameyang both through the middle, and then Ozil and Mkhitaryan to either side. It's that's makes perfect sense to me. Now again,
is it a bit narrow?
It's a bit narrow. That doesn't mean that Mkhitaryan and Ozil don't have wide capabilities. And if you put Bellerin, and I really want to see Klasnik given another shot at left back, then you add a lot of width there. There's a lot of athleticism coming down the wide from the fullbacks. I mean,
I agree. I agree completely. I can just see where this is going to end up.
Yeah,
Bellerin and Bonnet Allen essentially wingers. Mkhitaryan and Ozil is kind of those inside wingers, and then Mustafi and Kishoni on their own at the back, with a labouring Granit Xhaka marginally in front of them, lunging in on some absolutely whippet winger and getting a red card after the 15th minute. It's so inevitable, isn't it? It's just incredible.
I can picture it now.
Yeah. Do you think he'll play all four together, Henry? Or do you think he may take a more rotational aspect with three of the four playing for the majority of the games?
I think he'll play all four. It's my opinion that he should play all four because...
Yeah, no, I agree.
If we have any ambition to make the Champions League, we need to give, even though I've discussed the fact that the Europa League should be our priority, there is no reason to, at this point, disregard the possibility of qualifying through the Premier League. And if you've got to play your top players, in my opinion, I think the Europa League will become more of a priority the deeper we progress. I think we should beat whoever it is we're playing, Oster. And their name I cannot...
Ostersund. Yeah. FK Ostersund or something like that.
Thank you for saving my bacon there, because I had completely forgotten them. You could argue we could possibly see a rotation there, but moving forward, Manchester United implemented a routine last season, towards the end of last season, where they were playing their starters in the Europa League and playing their reserves in the Premier League. Yeah. It might come down to that in the end. But I hope that we see all four of them on the pitch, because if we're going to continue with this mentality of outscoring the opposition, they give us the best chance of outscoring the opposition.
Yeah. And actually, you can take the Manchester City approach where we say we're just going to dominate the ball so much that actually we're not going to have to defend that much. So we don't really need to think about defending because we've just got the ball for 70, 75% of the time. And also, when you lose the ball in those situations, like Arsenal will hopefully be in, they're so high up the pitch... The opposition have so far to go and they have no time and no space that you can force an errant pass and win back the ball quite quickly. I'd love to see Wenger implement a really high pressing, high intensity, high energy style. Whether he actually will and be really aggressive and kind of front footed football, I don't actually know if he'll do that. But that's what I would love to see, with all four playing really high up the pitch.
And then leaving those four to attack and the rest to defend would be ideal. But I think we have tried to implement a high press at times this year. The game at home against Tottenham comes to mind, where we really, from memory, really pressed them high up the pitch. So I think, I mean, on Aubameyang obviously comes from the renowned Jurgen Klopp system. Is it Uber Press or something?
That
might just be the company. Or something along those lines, where they're renowned for playing a really high defensive line and pressing really high up the field and defending from the front. So it'd be interesting to see, because that was also another drawback for Olivier Giroud, was that his defensive input wasn't necessarily great because of his lack of athleticism. But then again, and then Mkhitaryan obviously hails from Borussia Dortmund as well, and he's played under Mourinho, so he knows how to park the bus. So it's just a case of Ozil pulling his weight, which he's done more of in recent weeks. But yeah, I don't see any reason as to why we shouldn't implement it, because, as you said, we have the fullbacks to implement it. Monreal seems comfortable pressing the ball high up the pitch and intercepting the ball high up the pitch. And we have two athletic centre-backs who, while they may be prone to mistakes, athleticism is one of their strengths.
Yeah, they can certainly cover a lot of ground. And I think on Ozil particularly, his defensive shortcomings come when he's tracking backwards and he's asked to be disciplined and he's asked to be aware of the danger around him. Actually, he's actually quite clever at pressing the opposition high up the pitch. He's actually quite good at it and he's more than willing to do it. It's more when he's asked to go the other way that he's less interested, I guess. And also, if you have two disciplined centre midfielders, you can kind of say to Mkhitaryan and Ozil, we don't really want you to track back that much, to be honest. We kind of want you to stay quite high up the pitch and, I guess, enforce the opposition to be very wary of Arsenal's counter-attack. Because if you leave Mkhitaryan and Ozil relatively high up the pitch and you have the pace of Aubameyang and Lacazette as two strikers, that is a really blistering counter-attack. And if I'm an opposition right-back or left-back up against a Mkhitaryan or Ozil and they're not really following me back that much, I'm going to get a little bit nervous about how high up the pitch I'm willing to go, because I know that if one of my midfielders loses the ball or one loose pass, suddenly my two or three centre-backs are in a lot of trouble.
That's a very good point. That's a really good point.
It will certainly be interesting to see how Wenger chooses to juggle his many options he does have, which is somewhat unusual. One option that he has for a long time, and I know we've got a Twitter question on this as well, Mesut Ozil, and I still can't believe I'm saying this, this is the best piece of news for me, Mesut Ozil has signed to a new 3.5-year deal, which will keep him at the club until 2021. He will be, I think, 32 at that age, is that right? 32, 31, 32, something like that. Mm-hmm. So I'll come to you, Josh. What's he thinking?
I mean, that is a great question.
He loves London. That's what he's thinking. He wants to stay in London. Forget Arsenal. It's London.
Yeah.
I mean,
he does go to great pains to say that.
Yeah, I was gonna say you have to look back at all the times where he said, "I love the club. I love it here," and he was actually telling the truth. I mean, people say that all the time. I think Alexis even said Alexis hated it here. I mean, but Ozil, actually, you got to respect a guy that comes to a team and doesn't find the success he was looking for at that team, but appreciates their philosophy and their ways. And I'm not talking about their inconsistencies and how that's part of their philosophy. And I'm talking about, like, their actual, what they value as a club. And he shares their values enough to commit. I mean, honestly, to commit to the end of his career, because once he gets to 32, he's not going to be able to get a move to any club that he wants anymore. He's here through the most important parts of his career, where he's really trying to see what he can win as it all winds down. And honestly, it feels like it's such a good feeling to know that people like Ozil, who are notoriously is not a good word, renowned as being world class, still believe in this club. And if they can believe in it, then why shouldn't? I mean, that's why Aubameyang's here. There's still a magic about this club that can convince people to not just come, but stay. And that's the problem we've had, is getting people to stay. We've been able to attract people, but getting them to stay was another thing. And I think Ozil is, if you go back through all the players that we've lost, I think Ozil will be one of the top ones that we needed to hang on to, and we actually did. So what's he thinking? I think that he's found a place where he's comfortable, where he identifies with the club. He's happy here, and he really believes in what we're doing here. And that's a really refreshing, thing to see.
Yeah. I said at the start of January, I think it was on a podcast, maybe it was in an article, can't quite remember, but I've always held the belief that Ozil was kind of, he knew that Alexis Sanchez was going, and he knew that Arsenal were going to spend the money or the trade that they were going to get from Alexis Sanchez. And I was quite adamant, really, that Ozil was waiting to see who those players were. And if he was convinced by those players, he would choose to re-sign. And if he wasn't convinced by those players, he would choose to leave. I know when he came to the club that Wenger made quite a few key assurances that he was going to spend money and support him with other top quality attackers. And obviously the immediate summer after he signed Alexis Sanchez, and Ozil thought, oh great, this is going wonderfully, this is going, you know, excellently well. And then the summer after that he buys one player and it's a goalkeeper. So maybe now, 4.5 years later, Wenger is finally delivering on those promises of giving him some weapons to use. But certainly, I think, you know, in the last 6 months, adding Lacazette, adding Aubameyang and adding Mkhitaryan, Ozil's looking at and thinking, I can have a real, real nice end to the prime of my career, certainly, is what he's coming to, unless he's sold. And I, in the end of the day, I think that's why he's chosen to stay. And I also, I do think it's ridiculous, but I do think he loves London, and I think he's very settled there. I don't know about his family, but I assume he has friends and family, and they enjoy living in London, and he enjoys his personal life in London very much. And that is important. I know Olivier Giroud's wife, for example, didn't want to leave London. That's quite a large reason as to why he's imminently going to Chelsea, which we'll talk about in a second. It's because his wife didn't want to leave London, which is, I guess, a kind of factor that we don't often think about in terms of transfers, but these are people, and if you were offered a job, you would think about where it was and do I want to live in that city, and footballers are no different. I think Ozil does like living in London. Henry, last thing on this, do you think now that Arsenal will just be in the same situation with Ozil in 2.5 years' time, 2 years' time?
I won't be as concerned in 2 years' time because we, as a club, have, for the most part, yes, and we've always been a club who've tended to resort to younger talent anyway. I'm kind of surprised by the age of a lot of our acquisitions in this window in particular. I mean, it screams to me that Wenger's either trying to make one last big splash, or we're really looking at the short term in terms of Champions League qualification. But I think I might be wrong on this, and you might be able to tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe he has aspirations of returning to Turkey and playing when...
He's certainly very fond of his homeland, and he's very keen to point out his Turkish heritage in interviews and things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case.
And for the age, for the most part, he might be effective, but we've always been a club who've tended to, or who've had a younger average age. So for that, I wouldn't necessarily mind. But we've also have this tendency to only offer 1 year contracts to 30-year-olds, and that's not something that he'll really want, I presume, even at 30 years old, because his qualities usually bode well for a 30-year-old. He doesn't rely on pace or physical prowess. He relies on mental and visual capabilities, which you presume will last past his early 30s.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly look at David Silva at the moment for Manchester City. He's playing as well as he ever has, and he's getting towards the tail end of his prime, and it doesn't seem to be affecting him very much. I should give a shout out, this is my fault, I should give a shout out to Spence on Twitter, who asked the question of why on earth Ozil decided to stay. So that's at @SUH_Spence. So thank you very much for that question. If you have any more, then please get in contact with us, and we'll attempt to answer them on the show, because to be honest, I'm still not sure why on earth Ozil decided to sign that new contract. But
I mean, after last night, I was looking at the entire situation going, what on earth would possess you to stay?
I know. I saw it might be Gunnar Blog on Twitter tweeted out about half an hour after Chris Wheatley, which we should give great kudos to Chris Wheatley for. He was
and not
first...
David Ornstein and not
no,
David Ornstein.
Yeah, he was the first on this at about 8 o'clock this morning. So let's give a shout out to him, because he really nailed this in terms of getting the scoop. But about half an hour after he tweeted out that Ozil had signed or was signing a new deal, I think Gunnarblog tweeted out saying, "I'm not being, you know, kind of funny or anything, but I have absolutely no idea why Ozil would sign a new contract." And that's nail on head, isn't it? If I'm Mesut Ozil, I'm actively wanting to leave. I'm doing what Alexis Sanchez did and trying to get out of this absolute nightmare of a club. But apparently Ozil is a much better man than I am. So there we go. Right, let's move on
to... Or he's stupid.
Yeah.
No, we won't say that. GOAT. Greatest. All time. Not stupid. Definitely not.
Let's move on to a player who is a favourite of at least a couple of people here. Olivier Giroud is I don't... We are... I should say we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. It is currently 4:06 as I'm speaking right now. So I don't know if it's official. I've not seen anything official, but it seems as though Olivier Giroud will be signing with Chelsea in the next hour or so. We'll find out when that actually is. But all signs point to Olivier Giroud signing for Chelsea for a fee in the region of £18 million. It could be as low as 15. It could be as high as 20. We will see what it actually ends up being by 11 o'clock tonight. Let's just again take this deal in isolation, Josh, and then we'll come back to the whole question of how it involves with Aubameyang. I assume you're absolutely devastated to see Giroud walk out the Emirates door.
Devastated isn't a strong enough word, but there isn't a strong enough word. I told this story during the break, but
Do it.
Olivier Giroud has been my favorite player probably since he arrived. I don't know what it is. I always get attracted to the players.
Is it his hair?
No, although I do like the quiff.
Is it his... His dashing looks?
No, that's not it either. It's the whole being unappreciated thing. For whatever reason, I always get attracted to the players that I feel are unappreciated, which is probably why I defend Xhaka so much. But anyway, Olivier Giroud has been my favorite player since he's been with Arsenal, and everybody knows this. And I had to tell my fiance that he was leaving to go to Chelsea, and she actually had to get up and hug me and tell me it's going to be okay. I feel like I've lost a family member, which might sound kind of deranged. I'm not going to hide that. But, I mean, the deal itself, I don't like the deal. If there was no other way around it, then I'm forcing myself to be practical here. Then, of course, it makes sense. If you want to speak completely practically, I do think that this had nothing to do with Arsene Wenger. I've heard that theory posed many times that Wenger would have never sold Giroud, that this was a direct result of him not being in charge of transfers. That said, I mean, we've all heard it before, that he's the best plan B in Europe. If you're ever in a pinch, you throw him in there, you serve balls in the box, and you've got a pretty good chance of pulling some gold out. And I don't get why the fee was so low. I don't get why we didn't push for Welbeck to go instead. Hell, I would have rather see us pay for Fernando Llorente to go to Chelsea and keep Olivier Giroud. That sounds crazy, but I don't know. I can't. Maybe I'm still too emotionally blinded by this, but no. I can't quite wrap my head around why we were so willing to let him go. Not just because he's been a good servant to the club. That shouldn't factor into transfers as much as I'm letting it factor into my opinion of this. I just don't get why you'd get rid of such a useful weapon, especially given the context of the Europa League, where he's going to be one of our primary tools to qualify or to winning it all. I don't understand that, unless there's something else to come and there's, you know, transfer madness coming. But I've seen pictures of him shaking hands with people at Chelsea, so it's a done deal. All they have to do is announce it. But I don't understand it, but at the same time I fully wrap my head around the practicality of it.
What do you think, Henry?
I agree with essentially everything Josh had to say. I've been very vocal on Twitter about how he is, in my opinion, the best plan B in Europe, especially for the way that Arsenal play. He's a maverick in regards to the fact that he can excel outside of our traditional tactics. At Chelsea, he's probably more suited to their tactics, I guess. But you also put an interesting thread up on Twitter yesterday, Andy, about this guy who mentioned the fact that Giroud is approaching 32 years of age, has about 70 league goals in about 180 games, I think it was.
Yeah.
And you can look at it from both sides. He's not playing. I don't think he's necessarily guaranteed game time at Chelsea, if he goes to Chelsea. So I question it on his behalf as well, because I don't necessarily think he will get more game time. Granted, Alvaro Morata's finishing has been subpar. We saw that against Chelsea for ourselves. But I think he's a pretty good player. So I don't think he's going to start. I think the fee would suggest that he's not going to start. So I question it on multiple levels. I think we've been bullied in these negotiations. If it's true that we're paying for the Batshuayi loan and the fee is incredibly low, it seems that we're kind of feeling guilty for buying such a great player for such a great price. Oh, we've got to sell you cheap and help you with your acquisition. It just doesn't kind of sit right with me as an entire scenario.
Yeah, I agree with that. I am for selling Giroud, even without somebody else coming in. I would be for selling Giroud for the right price. He just doesn't suit what Arsenal want to do anymore, and I don't think he should suit what Arsenal want to do anymore. The key there is for the right price. I definitely don't think 20 million or whatever the price will be is the right price. And I definitely would have taken less money to sell him abroad had it been possible. Selling him to Chelsea should drive the price up even more. But the tweet you're referring to is from a guy called Andrew Thompson, who's a good fellow, actually. He's worth checking out. He said Giroud is about to be a third choice striker. He's bagged 73 goals and 179 league appearances. So it's, you know, a bit better than one in two. Sorry, a bit worse than one in two. It's not especially a great record, really, especially considering, given that he does go for very long periods without scoring goals, where he will start 7, 8, 9 games in a row and he'll maybe only get one or two goals. And that goal-scoring record has been inflated massively by his substitutes. Influence, I guess, which is something that is a major, major positive for Arsenal. But in the context of being able to sign Aubameyang, and in the context of getting a fairly decent fee for somebody who is 31, soon to be 32 years old, I'm actually relatively for selling him. I said to both of you as we were planning this podcast that we'll move on and talk about it as a context of the whole move. Essentially, Giroud's gone to Chelsea, so Chelsea can loan Batshuayi to Dortmund, so Dortmund can sell Aubameyang to Arsenal. That's the love triangle that's going on here. So without selling Giroud, Arsenal probably wouldn't be able to sign Aubameyang. That seems to be the likely pattern of the transfer here. I would let Giroud leave on a free if it meant being able to sign Aubameyang. I think that may seem a little bit harsh on Giroud, but if you have to pay £60 million plus Giroud to go and get Aubameyang, I don't think that's the end of the world. I don't think you're overpaying. I actually think that's a fairly good deal for Arsenal. So being able,
anything, this puts a lot of pressure on Danny Welbeck to step up and possibly be a superior plan B option. Yeah, especially in the Europa League, because he is a big guy. He's renowned for being a physical presence with his combination of pace and power, albeit he's a bit like Bambi on ice in front of goal. But I think there's an onus on him now to really make a step up, especially if he wants to get on the plane to go to Russia as well.
Yep. I don't disagree with that at all. Josh, do you think in the context of the move of essentially Arsenal have paid £40 million plus Giroud to get Aubameyang, do you think that is a good deal in full perspective?
I mean, it would be too irresponsible to say it's not a good deal. Of course, it's
even with your
my obsession, your
I was going to say fetish, but we can go obsession if you want. I that's a bit of a stronger word.
Yeah, let's go with that. It's more accurate. it's a good deal. I still wonder why, if this was the only option, then it's a great deal. I still wonder if it was the only option, though. I'm all about putting pressure on people because I think it brings out the best. I don't think putting pressure on Welbeck's going to help him. He's had pressure put on him before. he's been benched, he's been all these things, and he still honestly looks the same as he did whenever we first got him. He's not the plan B that Giroud is. He's never going to be the plan B that Giroud was. And I mean, it's obvious that what Chelsea were looking for in a striker, they wanted a big aerial target. So I can understand why Welbeck wouldn't just slide in and be the new subject for Chelsea, because they were after ridiculous things like Peter Crouch and Andy Carroll, and so it makes sense why they wanted Giroud rather than Welbeck. But I don't know. If this was the only possible way, then of course it's a good deal. If there were other ways we could have gotten this done, obviously we're never going to know, but I would have much rather preferred, even without knowing what those other ways could have been, I probably would have preferred those other ways.
Yeah, and definitely that's something that I agree with. Maybe this is being a bit naive of me, and Arsenal need to be able to keep their kind of relationship strong with Chelsea and Borussia Dortmund. But the Aubameyang deal was confirmed, I think it was about 10:30, 11 o'clock this morning, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The Giroud deal still hasn't been confirmed up to this point now. So that's a 4 or 5 hour window, something like that. If I'm Arsenal, I'm pulling the plug on the Giroud deal. As soon as Batshuayi was confirmed and official for Borussia Dortmund, and Dortmund have got their guy and Arsenal got their guy, I'm saying to Chelsea, right, the price for Giroud has gone up to £25-30 million, something like that. Now, that may be a little bit not unrealistic in the modern world, where Arsenal need to be able to continue to have good relationships with these clubs to do transfers in the future. Certainly, there's a strong link between the Van Persie transfer to Manchester United and the Alexis Sanchez transfer to Manchester United. Wenger and I think it was Ed Woodward both referenced the prior relationship that the two clubs had, saying that's why such a complex swap deal, which we see so rarely, that's why it was able to happen, was because the two clubs have worked so well together in the past. Unfortunately, it's been Arsenal selling players, but that's by the by, the relationship was still there. So maybe Arsenal did need to maintain that, but I'd have liked them to have been really ruthless and say, well, we're just going to keep Giroud anyway because we need him for the Europa League.
Yeah, I don't know why we can't just have one damn satisfying moment of pulling one over on us. They always pull one over on us. They always get our players. Why couldn't we have just once had just a perfect day without anything marring it? I whatever. It's done.
Yeah, I mean, we all remember what's his face, Demba Ba, and Arsenal.
Demba Ba.
Yeah, Arsenal trying to sign Demba Ba on the last day. I think it was the January transfer window again, or it might have been the summer. And Chelsea pulling the plug at the last minute and leaving Arsenal in a bit of a vice, really, when they were looking for a backup striker. Well, this is exactly the same scenario, where Arsenal could have pulled the plug on the Giroud deal. There are rumours, and they are growing actually, that Arsenal are interested in David Luiz. I'm not that enamoured by them, if I'm honest. Let me just ask you both, between now and the end of this evening, do you think they will actually come to fruition?
No. Very unlikely. I mean, we've been making claims after the game yesterday and for years, it seems, that an anchoring midfielder and centre-back are positions of weakness and that they need to be addressed. You could argue that Luiz is possibly an option that could kill two birds with one stone. I personally prefer him as a midfielder because, like Xhaka, lacks the instincts to be a holding midfielder. I don't think that Luiz has the natural instincts to be a central defender. I think he's much more useful as a midfielder. I wouldn't necessarily be against it, but I'm sceptical that it will happen at this point.
Yeah. Sky Sports have just tweeted out that the deal for Giroud is £15.3 million. Sorry, Josh.
We've been bullied. We've been bullied.
Yeah.
Into that, I think. I'm dead serious. We've been bullied.
So, again, we will see what happens between now and the end of this evening. It's not a great price for a player who is certainly worth more than
that. A deal that could rise to about £17.5 million. Which,
yeah,
if that is any consolation.
It's still not great, is it? Let's be honest.
Nope, not at all.
it remains to be seen what happens with the remainder of these deals. There's still a long way to go. But let's continue to look back a little bit more. Josh, overall, for the whole of January, are you happy with what Arsenal have done? And I'll include the re-signing of Mesut Ozil in that as well. I know that isn't technically a transfer, but I'll kind of group it all together as the January dealings.
Yeah, I'm trying to put thoughts of Giroud out of my head as I answer this question. But yeah, yes, I'm happy. You have to be happy. I mean, we've gone through so many January transfer windows wondering just what the hell is wrong with signing somebody in January. It just, Arsene Wenger has always been so opposed to it. So to come into this January window and not just get rid of Alexis, who had become a bit of a festering wound. I mean, he's massively talented. We all know that. But he was really becoming a problem. And you could tell by the way players reacted to him leaving that he had been a bigger problem, as big of a problem as people thought. Cutting Theo Walcott was brilliant. I mean, again, another really solid servant to the club, but he's somebody you had to get rid of. And then to bring in not just Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang, but, I mean, I don't want to forget about Mavropanos either, because it sounds like Wenger's been really impressed with him. This is somebody that Mislintat thought very highly of, and we know how good Mislintat is at identifying talents such as this. I mean, it's been a very, very successful window, doing a lot of things that are long overdue to be done, cutting dead weight, building for the present as well as the future. I mean, we really covered all the bases in this window.
Yeah, and certainly the Mavropanos deal is one of those no-lose deals. It cost, I think, about £2 million. His wages will be cheap, and it's one of them where you kind of just take a punt and you've got absolutely nothing to lose whatsoever, very much like the Rob Holding one where you just don't know what kind of play he'll develop into, and you maybe sign 10 of them and maybe two of them work out, but actually that will quickly recoup his value once you're able to sell those kind of players. Even for, you know, I suspect you'd be able to get £5 to £10 million for Rob Holding right now, which is certainly more than Arsenal have invested in him up until this point. So that's a very good deal. The two I'm most happy with, not including Aubameyang and Ozil, are actually Coquelin and Walcott, simply because Arsenal's shown a new ability to be able to sell players for a good price. I know that is a statement that challenges what they've just done with Olivier Giroud, but in terms of Coquelin and Walcott, for years Arsenal have relentlessly sold players for less than their value. Just in the summer, they sold Kieran Gibbs for, I think it was £6.75 million, something like that, and they rejected a bid of £10 million about a month prior. So they have an incredible ability of being able to get less money than they should. So I think both the Walcott and the Coquelin deals are examples of where they have actually maximised the price for the player. £20 million for Walcott in particular is an excellent deal, I think. And I think Everton will be happy with that deal, but to pocket £20 million, if you think, actually, in terms of the sales that Arsenal have made, they've essentially recouped the Aubameyang transfer fee if you include the profit that they made from the summer window as well. Henry, overall, are you happy with what Arsenal have done in the transfer window?
Yeah, I'm happy overall. We, as you've mentioned, we've rid of dead wood. Some young players have left on loan, which is good to see. You hope that they'll get some game time. Debuchy is supposedly on his way out. René Adelaide could possibly leave on loan today. Marcus McGuain left for Barcelona B yesterday, which is a fantastic opportunity for him. Julio, I might butcher this name as well, Pegazuelo has returned to Spain to a club who, again, a name I don't want to even try and pronounce, so I'll leave it at that. Chuba Akpom may also be leaving as well. So I think all in all, you couldn't really ask for more at this point.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are certainly questions to be asked about how Arsenal got into this situation in the first place with regards to Ozil and Sanchez, and there definitely needs to be a review of what went wrong and how they were allowed to let themselves become so vulnerable to allowing players to leave. But even in the summer, if you'd have said you can re-sign Mesut Ozil and Sanchez will leave for Mkhitaryan, I think most fans would have probably taken that. Certainly in January, every fan would have taken that. So from that situation, Arsenal have done very well. That doesn't mean they did well overall, because they should never have been in that situation, but certainly from January onwards, they have done well. Is there anything else from either of you that you want to touch on before we wrap up?
I do hope we're going after Max Meyer, apparently, from FC Schalke. And even if it doesn't happen in January, his contract's up in the summer. So it would be interesting if we could go after him, because he is, the best way to describe him is he is a German Santi Cazorla, and he's only 22 years old. And his transformation to a defensive midfielder this year has been nothing short of phenomenal. He's gone from a creative midfielder without a home, without a position, to the most effective defensive midfielder in the Bundesliga. He's better than Naby Keita. He's better than anybody else, because for whatever reason, his talents have just taken well to this position swap. And I think that if we're looking for somebody who can sort of put the pressure on midfielders, on opposing midfielders, who can really dominate passing lanes, this is the guy we should be going after. I mean, I think the best part of it is, just because he switched to this defensive role doesn't mean he's just all of a sudden lost all of his creative abilities. He's still got that creative instinct. We've seen it a lot with Schalke this year. But the fact that he's now looking more like N'Golo Kante is something to keep an eye on. And I do think, I mean, he's been linked to Spurs before, but now that he's getting a higher profile, I imagine he's aiming higher than Spurs. So hopefully that means he'll end up at Arsenal.
Shots fired by Josh at Spurs there.
Do you feel better now, Josh?
I do.
Now that Giroud is leaving.
Yes.
What do you think, out of interest, what do you think about the Lucas Moura signing for Spurs? Because I'm not worried by it at all, but I know a few other people are.
It's like Moussa Sissoko all over again. I'm not worried by him. I'm never worried by Spurs. They're not going to win anything. They never do.
No, they'll probably finish above us, though, so...
I don't care.
And yeah, then Pochettino will leave for Real Madrid and all will be right with the world, because he'll take Kane and Dele Alli.
I think the one I really want them to lose is Christian Eriksen, because I think if he leaves, the whole show comes tumbling down, actually. Probably not quite to the same extent as Kane, but certainly... For me, he's the one player who, if they lose, they would really struggle to replace properly. Anyway, that's enough Spurs talk for the year. Let's wrap it up then. So, you can find us all on Twitter. You can find us at Pain in the Arsenal on Twitter without an E in the there. Please get in contact with us if you've got any questions. We always like to try and answer them on the show as best as we can. You can find us at paininthearsenal.com as well. All our articles are up there. So go ahead and disagree with them and shout at them and debate with us. We're called fan-sided for a reason. We want to display an opinion that isn't necessarily agreed upon and discuss why that may be. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of your transfer deadline evening, assuming that you're listening before transfer deadline day ends. And we will see you after Arsenal's inevitable loss to Everton, in which Alex Iwobi scores an own goal because he's starting instead of Pierre Aubameyang. Goodbye.